Hi, everyone. This is John Saltis with Ron Yengich. We're back for another episode of the Bingham Boys podcast. Thank you all for listening in these past few episodes, and now we're off to do another one. Ron, how you doing?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Well, healing, I think, because you're looking at it, I still have some residue of my busted up face from last week, my face plant. So I'm at least out now, but it's been 10 days of like watching swelling go down, it's like the opposite of watching grass grow up, right?
Right. Well, the reason is because you want it to go down so bad and you don't want the grass to grow necessarily. But
yeah,
I mean, it's down, but
the stitches are out. You had stitches in a couple of places, but I got some residue.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing that you can't see is I've got on my my left leg, pretty good sized contusion still. And when you do a face plant, and I did, because like you can see my knuckles are covered. They went to the bone a little bit with scrape. How I got this giant contusion on my leg, I don't know. But it was swollen the size of my knee, right below my knee. And it reminded me, as soon as I saw it, I go, I've seen that before. And where it was on the track gang. And we talked about a little bit last week about the Bingham Clinic. Ron, you know, union bosses, or company bosses, weren't supposed to work, correct?
Right. They didn't work. They could do a little bit of work if it was necessary to help somebody finish something off.
So then I'll reveal the name because I didn't want to get someone in trouble. So our boss at that time, it was a fellow named Nathan Ish. Yeah. And you remember Nate.
No, remember Nate. And speaking of boxing and bruises, Nate gave some out. He was a good fighter.
He was a good fighter middleweight,
I think. Yep.
And he became a track boss on Kennecott, and I worked for him my first summer on Kennecott. He was one of the, at the time, I bet you there weren't three black employees on Kennecott.
No, there were not a lot of black people that worked at the mine early on and then up through the 40s, and it was simply because there were not a lot of black folks that applied for those jobs, and also, people forget that in Utah at that time, the population of black folk, African-Americans, or immigrants from other countries in Africa was very, very small. Really small.
It was. We just weren't exposed to too many cultures outside of European cultures in Bingham. Anyway, we're on the track, and Nate was spiking alongside of me. So I'll say that he wasn't working, as you said, because he'd get in trouble. He's now passed, I believe. And so he was helping somebody learn how to spike.
Sure.
And side by side, we're going at it, and Nate was strong as heck, you know. He crimped the rail, something hit, and the spike maul went askew. And he drove it right, the maul just smacked into my shin, like the big end
of
the spike.
Are you kidding me?
No, God, and it hurt. And it was like, I'm out of here.
Right.
Well, Nate is like, John, come here, I got to talk to you. Don't tell anybody it was me, you know. Don't tell me. Because, you know, truth is there were, probably, we can't deny that we grew up in a great place that was wholesome for all of us, and we came away with mostly good memories of everybody getting along. But there were racists among us, and one of the bosses, a section boss up there, never treated Nate kindly. And as a result, our gang used to get all kinds of crappy jobs, you know, because he was punishing Nate for being a black man.
Right.
And I was like, this is bullshit. You know, it was one of those things early on. You go, yeah, no wonder. You know, no wonder there's a whole society of pissed off people here. I mean, this is crazy to treat a man like that.
Right, and the fact that it had taken that long for someone to get that job. I mean, and I don't even think Nate was, he was the boss for the college gang, so he wasn't a full-time boss with the gangs, I don't think.
He may have become later, I don't know. I remember what was funny. Do you remember a guy named Raul Paz?
No.
Paz was a shifter operator. And he would come out every morning, 6 a.m., and he'd go, gentlemen, and he'd call us all that, good morning, gentlemen. And him and Nate got along famously, and partly because I don't think their coffee mugs had coffee in them. You know,
they had taken a nip.
They were frequent companions down at the liquor store in Leadmine, but Nate was a good guy. Anyway, I got dinged, and it reminded me of that, and I'll tell you, though, what it also reminded me of this, being in the clinic. We talked about being in a clinic last week. Just around near the clinic. Today is May 20th.
Right.
520.
520.
Well, 520 Main Street was where the house of, call it what you want to call it, the house of the rising sun, the house of ill repute, the house of joy, the house of pleasure, the house of,
a house of prostitution. People knew what it was, and there was one in virtually every railroad camp and every mining town and all of those places. Every river town had one too. I mean, in towns in Utah. And it isn't as though it was just working people who patronized those places. But the same thing happened in Salt Lake City with the rich and famous and the wealthy too. There were places where there were whorehouses and opium dens and stuff like that right down in Salt Lake City. I can't remember the name of the street right off the top of my head.
Is that the one with the red dirt or something like that? So people, they knew where you'd been if you were tracking red dirt around town.
Yeah, that was one of I think it was an old wives' tale. Probably it happened once, but Plum Alley is the name, name of it. But it wasn't open in the sense that it wasn't flaunted, but people knew what 5020 Main was.
Yeah, so my mother used to talk about how the girls would walk up to the clinic, and now mind you, she would be a school-age girl at the time, and you see this, and there was no ill thought of it at all. They were working, right? Well, you mentioned though, I happened to go on Facebook the other day, and I trapped some of these shots when you said who frequented these places. Mm-hmm. This is a note. This is our buddy again from Larry Osoro, who posted about this on the Bingham site. Mm-hmm. He said that, and he's got a picture of the building. It says the address of the building can be seen in this photo. When Joe Dispenza was mayor, he said most of the customers came from Salt Lake City in a yellow cab.
Yeah, that isn't surprising. I know that Jay Bracken Lee, when he was mayor of Price, the House of Prostitution down there, he started getting a lot of pressure from the state legislature to close it and some bars down. And Phil Hansen told me the story, great lawyer, great guy, that what Lee did, he became mayor of Salt Lake and governor of Utah, ultimately. He took photographs. You had somebody stand out and take photographs and then shared them with some of the higher-ups in the legislature to show them who was patronizing the place.
Yeah, right.
And that he would have to, if you shut it down, he'd have to explain to his citizens, this is what I had to do because look at the people that are coming down and patronizing and ruining Price. And they were people from Salt Lake City, of course.
Yeah, and there's a couple more. A fellow named Richard Brown, he says, as a boy, my father spoke fondly of the ladies. He told me he witnessed a very bad mining accident. It was the ladies, I assume from this brother, who were the ones who helped. They weren't just, they came out for the community. Another person, Larry Larson. We used to joke that 520 was the troop number of the Boy Scout troop. But here's one, I don't know if the name is spelled right, because I knew a contrato, but this is spelled a little differently. If you don't mind, I'll...
No, go ahead. I think these are interesting.
Well, this is one that Betty Ann left. And Betty Ann Contrato, the person who, the madam, was well known. Her name was Big Helen. So anyway, it begins, Big Helen became quite ill. I went to see her, of course, and found her in bed in her bedroom. I had always visited her in her big kitchen and so had never been in her bedroom before. The kitchen and her room were side by side at the front of the long, narrow building, each with its own narrow door opening into the sidewalk. The girls' rooms were opened off of a long hallway that ran all the way to the back. The door between the kitchen and Big Helen's room had always been closed, but that day it was open, and no one closed it after I went in to sit beside my good friend at her bedside and talk with her. A few minutes later, a man came into the kitchen to talk to the girls sitting there. Then he looked in the open door and saw me. Right away, he came banging in and said, "Hi, Helen." Then pointing to me, he said, "That's the one I want."
Oh, no.
The girls and Casey, and I don't know who Casey is, were quick about getting the fellow out, and the door closed. Then with tears in her eyes, Big Helen said, "Honey, you must never, never come to see me here again." She meant it, and I understood. So with tears in my eyes, I left.
It's an interesting story. I mean, I represented a lot of prostitutes as a defense attorney, streetwalkers and higher class prostitutes. And they were good customers in the sense that they understood that you retain a lawyer, you have to pay, and they never tried to cheat me and out of any money or anything like that across the board. And they were working girls. I mean, that's what they did. I mean, they had other aspects of their lives. I me and my law partners represented a group of young women who ran. The guy that had been, for lack of a better term, their pimp got killed in a gambling fight in Houston, Texas. And so these four women then ran their little house up in the Marmalade District of Salt Lake City. We're going back to the 1980s, 1990s. And they ended up getting charged with racketeering, so we represented them. But they all got out of the business. One of them bought a coffee shop. One of them became a teacher and was a teacher for a long time. One of them became a model. And then the other young woman got married and moved away and, for all we know, lived happily ever after. I mean, a lot of people that turn to crime come from circumstances where they have no other way out. And what I found about it, representing people that got in trouble over the years, was, I mean, literally, there but for the grace of God go I. It could happen to any of us. Most people aren't born with the wealth to keep themselves standing when there's nothing else, nowhere else to get a meal. And I guess really it's something that you got to think about. That one of the reasons I love being a defense attorney, we're a little bit off topic here, but was the fact that I realized that most of the people I represented, they'd committed a crime or been alleged to have committed a crime, but basically at their heart they were good people. And they may have had problems, drugs, of course, post our generation. We're a big part about alcoholism and other things, debt. But most of them, given the opportunity, wanted to work and were more than willing to work hard for the money they earned. I think one of the things that we forget in life, that it's not the oldest profession, but it's an old profession. And it's a profession because there are people that want to use that profession. And sadly, we've gotten to a point with the internet and all of the things that are happening, the human trafficking problems in the world, that it really is a genuine problem that we've got to be concerned about.
Yeah, I happen to agree. I've also, you know, because of where we grew up, I've never disparaged that profession for 5 seconds. And yet we all know that at a certain age level and all that kind of stuff, where abuse comes in, that's a verboten area. That wasn't where we grew up. It wasn't what we saw. It was what it was. You know, and you mentioned Price. Right up the road from Price was Helper.
Sure.
If you go to Main Street Helper today, at the lower part of Main Street, right, I guess it's Helper, there's a museum right there. I can't remember what they call it. But, you know, if you look up at the windows, they've got models of girls looking out the windows.
I don't know who the mayor that was in charge then. It's been a number of years ago. They did the mining museum. The mining museum's been there for quite a while. But they kind of opened it up to kind of a mining adventure type of idea. Just like we have at This Is the Place monument up by the zoo, which is really nice. And it's interesting to go see the buildings and stuff like that. That was kind of the idea, but I haven't been down there for a while. I haven't seen how much it's expanded.
Well, I don't know if it was illegal or just overlooked, but that's another topic another time. Prostitution is biblical. Should it be legal or not? You know, that kind of stuff. Hey, but anyway, museums. You just left one.
Yeah, I was in Milwaukee over the weekend watching baseball, but I have passed by this museum literally several dozen times and never went in. And then walked in the other day. It's called the Grohman Museum at the Milwaukee School of Engineering, which is a really nice campus in downtown Milwaukee that stretches over part of the old part of town. And they've adopted as part of their campus some of the old brewery industry buildings like Schlitz and Blatt's, and they've kept them. They're nice. But anyway, this museum is about working people, and it's the art of the working people. So a lot of sculptures, and I sent you some pictures, John.
Oh, those are cool.
And also paintings and mosaics, and it's all about working people and every type of work, from humble laboring in the fields like both sides of my grandparents' family did in Croatia and Italy, to foundry work and railroad work and, you know, being a tinner and, you know, doing things with tin. But it really is fascinating, and fascinating the amount of art that they have there and that they also reference that goes way back into great artists that have done paintings and also, as I say, sculptures of this stuff. And they have traveling exhibits that come in as well. But it was interesting to see, because this is kind of what this podcast is about. It's about coming from working class roots that maybe not lionized, but certainly honored in art throughout the ages, and certainly in Western Europe, which is where most of this stuff comes from.
Well, you know, I've got to see that museum. I've been to Milwaukee a number of times, but I've never seen that museum. I like anything that honors that ethic. You know, you go through history and you see all kinds of beautiful works of art by all kinds of, from statuary to artists and artisans. Now that you mentioned that, I'm struck by how many of those images, even in the modern era, some of the black and white photos of California farm workers and so on.
Sure.
Those are classic pieces of art. And we don't have any pieces of art that I think of that portrays a billionaire.
Well, no. I never thought it in those terms. But certainly not as a working person. There are none of those. But the, you know, I mean, ultimately, again, it's a common theme in what we talk about. Most people aren't born rich, okay? Wealth comes in stages and in ages. And so somewhere in virtually everybody's past, they had people that had to get dirty working. They worked for somebody else. They worked at the behest or the desire of somebody else. They had to please somebody else by their work. And they may have been apprentices in something, or they may have been in a depression in wherever they lived economically, so that they lost what they had and had to start over. And so we should honor, you know, working people. And I think this is it really is a fascinating museum. I'm going to let you take the book
home
because it's cool. One of the interesting things, though, that they had in the museum was they have a section of art and sculptures about self-medicating people. Mm-hmm. So people that there's a really neat painting of a man attempting in a mirror to stitch the cut in his own forehead, which kind of relates to you.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, bring it home to you. But because, and this is the point that is made in this little area, is that these folks didn't have doctors. The idea of a safety net is relatively new. The idea of wanting to take the safety net away is old, because it's called greed. And so we're going through that time right now. But it was just fascinating to see these. It really, I mean, to me, I'm a Philistine when it comes to art. I can't draw a circle. But the beauty with which this is done and how realistic it is of people being treated for broken legs and all of this stuff in various types of work-related injuries.
Well, yeah, people misunderstand from my point of view what a working man is or what unions represent truthfully. And the real formative years of modern-day unionism, you know, was not about making another dollar an hour. It was like safety and working conditions and being more valued than a mule. That was really a great part and parcel of what was going on there. Treat me like a human being. And this great class structure is not new, the class disparity. But I'm speaking for myself. I've never been envious or jealous of people who have made a success of themselves, made lots of money, been wealthy. I know a good handful of billionaires that I've met over time. And legit guys like that. And they're good people. That's not it. It's not just the money side of it. It's how people treat other people to me. And you can become wealthy without giving up that sense of your soul to become a better person. You can still be a good person. You don't have to be an asshole. But today we lionize the wrong side of that for some reason. And the society does and values it a little bit differently. And, you know, if you have money, you don't have to be part of those people who get dirty. And if you're
right.
dirty, the people who you don't have to like the people who pay you or whatever. And it shouldn't be that conflict because everybody wants to get ahead.
No, I think to me, it's always been, I guess it was taught in our house. I mean, about you give a full day's work for a full day's pay. And it's not just the people that run a company and that may even have had the idea of what they were going to do better or something when it takes other human beings to move it along. And in my mind, if you look from outer space and you see the hole that was once a mountain at Kennecott, yeah, there was a lot of great engineers and a lot of wealthy people that put money in and deserved a return for all of that. Wise men that owned the company, some not so wise, they took risks. But it's the people that actually dig the hole who deserve the right to be paid for the hard work that went into it. And also, if they get hurt there, or if they get hurt somewhere else, or their kids do, or their wives did, or their husbands did, that there's a sense of responsibility that the people that are making the most out of that have to them. When you go to the Bingham City Cemetery, it's stunning how many little gravestones are there that say, Baby Saltus. And there are a lot of these.
I have two ants in there.
Baby Yangich. And that's it. And because the care that was given women who were pregnant and carrying children of working people, that they weren't as important as other people were. And when we talk about unions, we have to talk about that aspect of it as well, which was, if we're working for the company, many times living in a company-type town, where it's basically owned by the company, then you're responsible also to take care of our families. And over time, Kennecott got a lot better than that. But they got better because there were people willing to say, it's your responsibility. You have it to me. You have it to my family as well.
The early stories of up there were very harsh. You know, right. You know that. The National Guard in Utah was called out to shoot striking Europeans.
Like, in 1906.
Yeah. So, you know, and so later on in our era, Kennecott was more of a benevolent company in terms of, if you're going to talk about corporations, they had a TV show, the music is on at the end of our podcast, right. And that sponsored for the whole community benefit. They paid a huge amount of taxes to your high school mine and all that. But, you know, in that era, just was the era I think you just mentioned was basically about the 50s era. And it's not lost on me that much of this Make America Great Again notion actually falls back to about that era.
Their thought process does,
but think what was strong in that era. Unions.
Right.
Working people were respected. And then over time, through, you know, different presidencies up to, say, Reagan, when things were deregulated and pushed aside and so on, the working person and unions were kind of splintered and all that kind of stuff that went out of it. And that power, if you want to call it the power's base of that working union man, went away to a large degree. And it's lessened that greatness. If you want to make America great again, bring back rights and dignity and strong unions for the working man.
And the working man and woman today.
Woman, absolutely.
May well simply be somebody that's working in front of a computer at home, and because that's how it's being done. I mean, when I hear talk of bringing back manufacturing, in a way I think that would be great. Okay, there are things that can be manufactured in the United States and we can do a good job and jobs will come with it. We're no longer the primary mover in the Industrial Revolution. That's past us because of the simple economics from the perspective of companies that we just can't pay American workers what we can pay somebody, which is to say American workers aren't willing to be slaves. And in some places, they're forced to be still. And that's the problem. I mean, the idea that the 50s was great, not for everybody, but it was a movement toward greatness because, in large part, again, I'm biased in this way, not because of benevolence, but because of hardworking people who put their necks out on the line and were willing to fight that they got paid an equal distribution, fair distribution of what they were making for other human beings.
Well, here's how money's distributed now. You pay a pretty high price to watch a basketball game, and we all pay higher prices to watch those basketball games on TV. And 10 or so people accumulate how much in value? We just now had, didn't we not? Utah went to number, what was it in the Jazz pick?
Well, I think we get to pick fifth. The Utah Jazz tanked an almost entire season so they could get in running for the most recent great white hope in NBA basketball, Cooper Flagg. Great player from all comments about him. And
has the right name. It would have sold in Utah.
Sold in Utah. And I think that that's what the Jazz were hoping for. They mortgaged their future. The Jazz will never be good in minor your lifetime. That's going to be impossible. Danny Ainge has collected a lot of draft picks. I'm convinced that he and his fellow BYU guy who owns the Jazz, Mr. Smith, would play with holograms if they could and not pay them as long as they were still getting fans in the arena, but more importantly, TV money from the NBA. And it's interesting that in a so-called fair, the Dallas Mavericks got the first pick, and they're under incredible attack for letting Luka Doncic go to the Lakers and all of the flack they've taken. And they get rid of one Slovenian great player, white player, if you want.
The best.
Yeah, and he or Jokic.
Yeah.
And then bringing in this kid. And so it's you wonder whether somebody had their finger on the scale with the NBA so that that could happen. But it's not going to happen with the Jazz. And it makes me sad because the Utah Jazz, when they were good in the Stockton and Malone years, really brought Utah together. Not just Salt Lake City, they brought Utah together. It wasn't BYU in Utah where you pick sides, and we all have, or Utah State or whatever. It really did bring them together, and people loved that team. My mother became a Jazz fan.
You go to Greece today, and they still refer to Stockton and Malone. It's like, it's just crazy.
I mean, all that is now is a car dealership. But the sad thing is the way it runs now, it is truly is about money only. Larry Miller, God bless his soul, wanted to make money and was good at making money. But I'll tell you what, Larry Miller wanted to put a viable product on the court or on the baseball diamond or the softball diamond with whatever his name was involved in. And I just don't see it now.
Well, I was kind of looking at it. I don't know what the Utah Jazz as an organization grosses today, but it's more than Kennecott did in the 1950s. And they employed a few thousand people. So it's true. You know, I've seen a payroll, you know, in the old magazines of Kinescope, you know, our payroll this year, $5 million or something, and there was 5,000 people working there. Doesn't matter. But you know what was on this draft, the only thing I paid attention to, because I'm a conspiratorialist, is apparently out of the five out of the last 10 or maybe five in a row, the team that traded away their superstar.
Yeah, that.
They got the first round pick in the draft. You know?
I mean, that's what a lot of people are talking. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. However, I don't trust Major League Sports at all. I think that the whole thing with us, and I'm a baseball guy. I'm a part owner of a minor league team, the Ogden Raptors. That organized baseball screwed us by getting rid of the Pioneer League as one of the leagues that was with organized baseball. Now we're an affiliate organization, so they don't have to pay us anything. For about $3 million, they got rid of 20 cities that supported minor league baseball and loved it, and it was good, for $3 million, okay? This is the same band of folks that paid Shohei Ohtani $750 million in his contract and allowed him for tax advantages to defer a good part of it. So they're only looking at these minuscule amounts of money they can keep, and they don't care about Ogden or Idaho Falls or Billings, Montana, or these places where in the summers, there are people that make money working at those ballparks, not just the ball players. They don't pay them piss either in the minor leagues, but there are communities that are able to have jobs there. But Major League Baseball didn't want to do that. And it just irritates me to think that they sell it as you have to, if you're a good Utahn, you should support the Utah Jazz and the Utah Hockey Mastodons or whatever they're going to be called. And in my opinion, in some respects, particularly the Jazz and the hockey team, they should be boycotted because Smith and Danny Ainge are the ones that are bringing in all, I'm a Utah guy, they're bringing in all of the high talent to make BYU a
powerhouse
in football and basketball and probably everything else. And so, you know, I've never said this publicly before, but I won't buy a Jazz ticket. I won't buy a hockey ticket. And the reason I won't is because if I'm giving Smith my money, then he's sending folks down to BYU. And I'd like to be disabused of that notion, but I don't think I will be.
You can say this in any way you want, Ron, but that's a stance.
No.
Good.
Maybe we'll start it here.
Start a movement. You know, but do it around what you're talking about. And this is, we'll call that Ron's conspiracy, that all the money goes there. Because there's another one that's a conspiracy, and that is that the Democrats did wrong by Joe Biden. And somehow, you know, in the past two years, it was a big, giant conspiracy of the Democratic Party and of the left to do all these secrets. Well, the deep state secret that Joe Biden wasn't all there, and some other machinery was pulling every trigger for Joe Biden, and blah blah blah. And well, now he's,
you know,
going to die of cancer pretty quickly, right?
So. No, I mean it seems like. I mean it's too bad. I like Joe Biden. Joe Biden's one of us. Joe Biden comes from working class roots. He was a good guy. He wasn't perfect in everything he did in Congress for some people on the left, but he was a solid congressman and then senator and then vice president for Obama, and known as a good guy, known as across the aisle guy that would work with people, that knew that politics meant that there had to be compromise and all that stuff. And I fall into the literal conspiracy aspect of this. And let's put his wife aside, okay? You know, his wife, it's a separate deal. And she doesn't want her husband, who's beginning to become diminished mentally because of dementia or Alzheimer's, for that to be how he's last remembered. I get that. So let's put her aside. But other people that were there, and that includes Kamala Harris and anybody else that was in, and the inner circle of people that like Trump or Biden or Obama or Reagan, it's a big inner circle. There may be two or three that are at the top, but it's a big inner circle. They're responsible to the country. Mark Twain said it best. My party, right or wrong, meaning political party, is like my driver, drunk or sober. And you know what? It's the truth. And that is exactly where, I don't know if it was an actual conspiracy, which is to say people did things that were wrong knowing it and came to an agreement to do it, but it sounds like it to me. They had a responsibility to this country to let us know and find a way to do it, not at the last minute. He was unable to serve. I brought the Constitution with me. I mean, this wasn't in...
And that's bigger than Mike Lee's. I'm looking at this. It's...
That is, it's got the Declaration of Independence.
This is backpack size. This isn't pocket war. This isn't that trivial stuff that he has.
No.
Missing pages.
I like to call Mike Red. You know, I call him Red Lee because I really believe that he read a book once. And so we should call him Red. I don't think he's read many since he became a Trumper. But I'm going to refer to him as Red Lee from now on. Because by God, he read a book once. And let's get him credit for it as he tries to burn other people's books.
Yeah, he's something else, that guy, huh?
Yeah, but I want to just...
What do you got there?
I've just got the 25th Amendment. Presidential Disability and Succession. In 1967, this became the law of the land because we were concerned. And you know who was most concerned? It was the Republicans that were concerned that FDR in his last year, it took him 22 years to get this passed, and legitimately so, that maybe other people were running the government that weren't elected. The government, not their party. And so that was passed. It's a good thing to have on the books, how we deal with this, an infirmity, okay? But for the Democrats who knew...
Give a little bit more what the 25th... What does it say?
I'll read a little bit of it. It says...
I'm getting your intent, but yeah.
In the case of the removal of the president from office or his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president. And then it goes on to say who follows. That has been basically from the beginning. But it acknowledges that there may be a time when the president has to be removed as the leader of the executive branch of our country. But anyway, Democrats knew this, and they did. And we know that now because they're talking about it. The one thing you learn about defending drug cases is this, conspiracies. Somebody's going to talk sometime, okay? So as you think you got, I've told this to clients 1,000 times, believe me. Yeah, well, nobody's going to talk, Ron. Nobody's going to, well, believe me. Somebody's going to talk eventually. It's inevitable. They're going to all talk now, and they're going to write books about it and make money. This is deplorable. It literally is deplorable. Everybody that is elected to office of the presidency and the people around them swear an oath to the Constitution of the United States to defend and protect it. And so those people, and again, I'm putting Biden's family aside, even his knucklehead son aside, they owe us an explanation, and they owe not the Democratic Party, to hell with it. They screwed that up too. They owe this country an apology because they let a good man who was sick, he was sick. Anybody that's dealt with dementia or people that have it, no, it's a tragedy. I mean, it supplants Shakespeare for tragedy. But they sat there and they didn't say, Mr. President, it's time.
There's when you mentioned FDR, I mean, most of the country did not know he couldn't walk. And they hid that for how many decades? Was he capable? Yes or no? Were a lot of things. I was in the Biden camp prior to the debate when he walked out on stage, and I shit my pants. I go, who is that, and who let him on stage? That was just a horrible. It was just like heart sink. And Trump. If you looked at his face demeanor, he went from a guy that knew he was probably going to get beat by Biden
again,
and all of a sudden he looked across there and said, "I'm a lion. I'm the top of the food chain, and I'm going to go eat that warthog right now." And he did, and he hasn't let up.
No.
And he's still after Biden. I mean, Biden's been away from the office for 6 months, damn near. This is the election anyway, and he will not let go of Biden. And that's a sad tale. I agree with you. Something was amiss. Now we can look back and say what was wrong. Why didn't we know? But we can ask the same thing right now because Biden had an auto pen. Therefore, nothing works. Well, Trump's an auto pen. He doesn't even know what he's signing. So
no, but I'm going to just push back just a touch. I hate that argument as a lawyer. Okay, all right. If the prosecutor's case that I was arguing against was wrong on the law and wrong on the facts, how something else played out was totally irrelevant. We can deal with that down the road. Democrats have to deal with this.
Oh, I don't know. No, I'm on that.
I'm not saying you're not, but I don't want to hear them go on and go, yeah, well, now we've got to look at Trump. I heard this.
Okay.
Let's look at Trump now. Excuse my language. It's proper...
mining language, go ahead.
No, it's proper legal English. Oh. Bullshit. Okay? Stick with the problem. Deal with Biden. And then try to regain the high ground if you're going to go after Trump for having the same type of issues. Because we let this happen again.
Well, you're right. I get what you're saying. And I'm not going to call it a lapse. I see it every day. You know, like I said, and it's just there. But the Democrats do need to tell a better story. They need to own their mistakes. They need to have a better story to tell. They need better leadership. They need more honest leadership from the top. You're right. That begins it. And then go on the other side. I just hope it lasts that long. I reminded, like, Nate, right now, some of my commentary about the current president is a bit of resignation. So I'm not really, I don't want to be in whataboutism. I'm not saying, yeah, but, I guess in a, you may have heard it that way, but I'm not really trying to express it that way. What it really comes down to is I've come to look at it like, instead of being angry, I'm looking like, wow, in 1,000 years, they're going to be writing about this. And I'm part of history. I'm watching history develop. So this is going to be a big story. I mean, the guy was elected twice with a gap in between and all that kind of stuff. And who would have known he'd win? This is historic. But it's also historic in this way. And I feel like the, you know what a troodon is? Troodon was like a dinosaur. It was about 3 feet tall, weighed about 10 pounds. I think when those little guys ate the pudgy guy in Jurassic Park. But the troodon was considered a smart dinosaur because its head-to-body ratio was larger than other dinosaurs. So it was a smart dinosaur. So if I was a troodon, or he was me, we're looking up and the asteroid is coming.
Right.
And he can see it. He knows the asteroid is coming. He just can't do anything about it except bitch and moan. But it's going to land in the Yucatan. It's going to blow up. It's going to exterminate his way of life on Earth as he knows it. He knows it's coming. He can't do a damn thing about it. And that's what I feel about, like, right now. Some of the stuff that is taking place is more of, wow, it's bleak.
No, I don't feel that way. I don't at all. I don't say because I believe in the other generations. I mean, they've got their own problems. I believe in it because I honestly believe that the framers of our Constitution were really smart, and we've been in periods before where the Constitution and the rule of law was under attack, and they're when it got down to the nitty-gritty, people came and rallied around what we believe in that has always made America good, as you say. What makes it good is that we realize as people that you just can't let go of 200 plus years of the greatest experiment in self-government just because we've got someone that we don't like, or we have had people on our own side who haven't had courage to stand up and do the right thing. And I think that we're going to get past it, but I don't think we're going to get past it without a lot of pain.
No, you're right. I don't like the president. However, I'm not afraid to, or I will compliment and have, in fact, you know, if he does the good things. And there's certain things in MAGA that I kind of go, yeah, we need better borders. Yeah, we need this or that. That's not it. It's that defending the Constitution and watching the meteorite come, the asteroid. I don't recall a time in history where the Constitution that you have there was under such attack. Now, you're the historian, and I don't know, but I don't remember a time when the whole House of Congress kowtowed, the entirety of the House basically kowtows to one person the way it does. I don't recall that the Senate did also, that the courts, you'll have two justices who will never side against this fellow. And so that triumvirate of the three branches of government is falling apart. And that's what I'm looking at, that dishevelment. And you're right. Will time heal it? Will there be the strength to do it? Absolutely want it to be. I want to divert the asteroid, but I see it.
But see, I think that your analogy to the asteroid is a good one in one sense, but on the other hand, it isn't, because this is all interior to the United States. This isn't a problem coming from the outside. This is stuff that we are doing. We are doing to ourselves.
It's our own gold.
We are the asteroid. Let's do it that way. We're the asteroid. We've got to take a look at this and say, you know, we're going to destroy everything. Both sides have to say that. Both sides of Congress. Supreme Court justices have to look at it. And there's been a little bit of movement there from them.
Yeah.
And state politicians. But it's just basically people that have to say, okay, Ron, you don't like Trump. Great. But what do you think about this that he did? Just like you just said. And I can say as a Democrat to my fellow Democrats, let's stop talking about what Trump did and is doing only. Let's talk about how we gave him the reins to do that. And then maybe you can come up with a true opposition. That's where I think we will get where we're going. I hope.
That part, I agree with that. We sure gave it up in that last election. However, the reasons were, you know, that we started talking on Biden for a sec, or it could have been, you know, voting against a woman, voting against the process, voting against a black woman. There's a lot of that, too. It's a crazy system when only 30% of the population voted for him, and yet it's enough to control all those houses.
But so the other people that didn't vote can easily fix it. Yeah.
If they're allowed to vote, this is the thing, right?
Well, that's part of it, too. You bet.
Okay. Hey, we don't have much more to go on him. And we've already committed in each one after the first one. We're not going to talk about our favorite president so very much. But let me ask you, as we're, you know, locally, what's happening is switching off. We'll bring it up next week, and you can explain how we'll do it, is book banning. And we just had, I think it was Utah's 18th book banned yesterday. Is that right? 18th, 17th. Water for Elephants or something.
Yeah.
I don't know much about the book. I remember it was a movie. That's all I remember. But this is our state in action doing the undoing of certain practices and rights and so on, if you want, you know, wants. What do you think about book banning? Just generally, and tell us where we're going next week.
Well, I mean, book banning is book burning. I mean, why people fear somebody writing something has always stunned me. And yeah, it may be bad stuff. I'm not talking about the books that were banned, but it opens you up for discussion about it. And there's some nuances to it about should a child read this book or that. But anyway, we're going to talk about the books that were banned. We're not going to go to other books. We're going to have somebody and possibly be on, or try to talk about those 18 banned books. Somebody that's read a number of them to tell us what they're really about.
So we'll bring this as a guest.
As a guest, and have somebody tell us, well, this is what this book is about, and this is where they may think it is bad, but that's not really what it's about. It's part of the story. It's part of the narrative. And some of the books that were banned were poetry books, which really stuns me.
In Utah, you mean?
In Utah, banned in Utah, yeah. And so it really stuns me. And so I think we need to talk about that.
We will. You know, a lot of it, the banning is about prurient kind of things. Mike Lee wants to redefine pornography, for example. So I'm guessing, without looking at them, the 16, 18 books, that it's going to be because it has a sexual reference or something inside of it that is not liked by Utahns. And
or
so the book is banned.
Or by some Utahns, okay?
I mean, enough to ban the book.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, and again, we'll talk about it next week, it isn't that you just get to ban something because you don't like it. I mean, or because it offends a sensibility. Good literature is intended to do that. But we need to have somebody that has read them and says, I like this book, or I don't like this book, and this is why.
Let me read you a quote.
Right.
Okay, here's a little quote. Tell me if you know where it came from. If you're in trouble or hurt or need, go to poor people. They're the only ones that'll help. The only ones.
No, who?
It's written by John Steinbeck.
Oh, really?
It's in The Grapes of Wrath. Yeah. The Grapes of Wrath has no sex, has none of the other stuff.
Right.
It was banned in Kern County, California.
Right.
It was banned in Buffalo. It was banned across the U.S. It was banned across the South. So once you enter into that slippery slope of banning books, it isn't about little horny kids anymore. And as a matter of fact, it's usually not horny kids. It's horny adults who go after innocent kids. You know, ban those people. Don't them get the damn book. But anyway, that's an example of banning something without the cause that people think banning is good. You ban classics, American classics.
Sure.
The story of that family in Grapes of Wrath is classic Americana. It's American great. That book was banned.
Yeah.
What else is going to be banned?
Yeah. And we'll end with you on saying that, because that's what we need to talk about.
We will.
All right.
Okay, that's it. Wrap it up. I'm scratching my itchy self because of all these scabs and stuff. Good to see you again, Ron.
You
glad
too,
you're
Jim.
Back in town. Take care.
And you too. I'm glad you're feeling better.
All right. We'll see you next time.